Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, October 16, 2010. I'm Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic today is Foreclose on the Empire with Glass-Steagall. Now, I'm glad to say we have here in the studio John Hoeffel. Welcome, John.
Hi, Marcia.
Whom many of you know well, and he has written an article just a few hours ago for EIR Online and Executive Intelligence Review for next week with that exact title. I'm sure we all know what gave rise to using the word foreclose on the empire instead of smash, obliterate, vaporize, with the phenomena around us that John will be talking about. Of what is, he likes to put it in quotations, the home mortgage foreclosures, mortgage securitized instruments crisis. But I'm very glad to say we have on the line from outside a meeting in Massachusetts in Taunton of the LaRouche Political Action Committee, Spencer Cross. Welcome, Spencer.
Thank you, Marcia. Hello.
Hi. And, Spencer, I think this event is on, well, it's on the whole, our mission and what we're doing right now, but in particular on Glass-Steagall, is that right?
Yes, on Glass-Steagall and the NAWAPA plan as well.
Okay, great. And just to put, by way of introduction, let me just underscore this. However much we talk about any details about it, our mission is seeing that as fast as possible, President Obama is put out of office, ousted, retired, however it comes about. And Mr. LaRouche, you know, less than 2 weeks ago, put a particular edge on all this by saying you can do it very efficiently with the 25th Amendment to the Constitution. People who haven't done so, look up Section 4, and it spells out very clearly the procedures to use to remove from office, keeping continuity with government, remove from office a president who is not able to carry out his duties, which is what we're seeing with President Obama saying we're in a recovery. He was saying all the other things I won't catalog right here. But he's even saying that in Massachusetts right now, he's in Boston. Spencer can tell us about it this afternoon. He's on these blitz tours. Now, LaRouche putting this out, use the 25th Amendment, which we've been organizing for all around the United States. In fact, people are very encouraged internationally to be put in the picture on this so that we have a prospect of getting the obstacle of Obama out of the way so we can take the right emergency measures here and abroad. So people are very torqued by this, that you can do it, it must be done. And, of course, this is the same momentum that in terms of what we need to get Obama out of office as is behind how obvious it is that we need to reinstate the Glass-Steagall principle and, in fact, the law that we once had. So we are up against the imperial system in all of this for whom Barney Frank serves, that Spencer may want to reprise what the campaign of Rachel Brown did and is now doing. So we want to get rid of these obstacles. And because Spencer's going to resume, is going to go back into the meeting, we want to speak the first half of the show, especially with what he wants to report from New England. So I just want to make 3 points about this, that what we're making way for here in hour-by-hour organizing to get rid of these obstacles, as I mentioned, calling Obama that, is the opportunity for credit for rebuilding nations, for going ahead with what we ought to be doing on our continent, the North American Water and Power Alliance, that creates the platform for moving ahead, going out into space, which is the destiny of humanity. And be sure to watch several times the new LaRouche Political Action Committee feature videos, one on the Arctic, NAWAPA extended, it hones in on this, the far north, and the other on the extraterrestrial imperative about our galaxy, where we stand in the universe. And I also want to say several times during the show, keep in mind a few Saturdays from now on November 6th is at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, an international webcast by Mr. LaRouche. And with that, Spencer, you're speaking there in Taunton. Do you want to open by just saying anything about the event or the entire process it's part of since the Rachel Brown election and in New England anyway? Go ahead, please.
Sure. Well, I think the interesting thing is that Mr. LaRouche has described over the last, since last August, a process of what he described as a mass strike process in the population, where he's often quoted the poet Shelley's article on defense of poetry, where he says maybe you can paraphrase it better, but there's an increased ability of the population to receive and impart profound perceptions respecting man and nature. And I think that's, that erupted originally with some of this healthcare issue that was coming up in the population. But Rachel's campaign really just tapped into that and I think mobilized the best aspects of that ferment in the population. You have one side that's like the Tea Party side, which, has its problems and a certain populist orientation. But we were just organizing for about 10 months. Essentially, look, we got to reorganize the bank system. We have to end the bailouts. We have to separate the legitimate banks from these, speculative vulture banks that are there to destroy nations and populations. And we have to get Obama out, and we have to go with these projects like Franklin Roosevelt. And she really just stuck to her guns on the truth in mobilizing this, the fourth district, which was Barney Frank's district, because, let's face it, Barney Frank is just the poster boy, and he's not even that good of a poster boy. Yeah, not a poster boy to look. But the poster boy for this sort of speculative evil with finance, with the City of London's control of the United States. And so we just went out there and we mobilized. We got a fifth of the vote in the population, where one out of five Democrats and Independents in Barney Frank's district itself said, look, we have to end these bailouts. We have to go with impeachment. Obama is acting like a fascist right now. We have an AWPA development program that LaRouche has laid out. And so that's just a little bit of the background anyway. There was 10,000 people that came out and voted for Rachel, including 1,200 in Barney's hometown of Newton, Massachusetts. This is one of the most liberal areas of the country. And they just came out, and Rachel got the same amount of votes as the top Republican contender, who, is just some of the worst of this Tea Party crisis. So what we did was we said, okay, in discussions with Mr. LaRouche, and Rachel said, look, this is, my campaign is not over. She's not running for Congress, per se. But she said, this is, one way to think about it is what Rachel said, that Barney's at the end of his career. He's used up. There's certain indications that he's finished as a useful tool, as a useful, high-level thug for this financial empire. But my career is just beginning. And we're going to take these, 10,000, and really, if you think about the general area we organize, because, there are plenty of people in these regions we organize that were unable to vote for Rachel because they just don't live in the district. So you take like 10,000 to 20,000 people in this district in the Northeast. And that's going to be the foundation and just the Gideon's Army core, this political movement that we can take to begin organizing everywhere, in New Hampshire, Maine, Vermont, Connecticut, Rhode Island, all these institutions, the scientific institutions. So Route 128 was the area where NASA really had a certain foothold in technology with the Apollo program. This is just outside Boston. You have Connecticut, which is the insurance capital of the U.S., I think the world. John can correct me on that one. And we just did some work there the other day, and we can tell you about it later. So that's the general thrust is we have this army, we're mobilizing the citizens further to get the Glass-Steagall passed, even bring the Congress back. That's going to include getting Obama out immediately with the Fifth Amendment. So that's just at least a little intro to what we're up to here.
Well, that's great. And let me, I understand you mentioned Rhode Island and the New Hampshire and so forth. I understand you have been, some of your core organizers have been fanning out into these places. And maybe you could say about the response. One thing is, and also about the condition of the economy, even though you think this collapse process continuing. I understand you were in Berlin, New Hampshire, for example. What's the picture?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two stories I would say. There's one is up into Connecticut. We had a big, our entire campaign volunteers up here went out into Connecticut the other day, and there was a machinist conference we wanted to hit. And John, isn't Connecticut the insurance capital of the world?
Yeah.
Am I wrong on that? Yeah, it is. Okay. So we went to Hartford.
Hartford. It's almost emblematic, isn't it? What
yeah.
Pittsburgh was to steel, Hartford is to insurance.
Yeah. Yeah, so we went there, and there was a really electric response. We had this one lady told me that she said, "Look, I don't know what it is, but this town and this state, it just seemed like one big casino to me. It seems like all corruption and crime." And she just responded really well to Glass-Steagall. We had, squads that were just reporting that, you know, you're talking like three quarters of the people you're talking to are three-piece suits. Talking these three-piece suits that are all on insurance. And they all know that Glass-Steagall is what we need to do. And, you know, there were some questions about Obama. They weren't sure. There was a lot of good response from Obama, too. But even this insurance group, they know that we need the Glass-Steagall. And we spoke with industrialists, people that were, tool and die makers, machine tool operators. And they were describing some of the breakdown of the Connecticut River Valley, which goes, I think, from New Haven through Hartford up into central Massachusetts. And we're asking, well, where can we go to organize some industrial layers? Because, you know, this, you're saying this used to be one of, you know, a certain, at least, major artery in this area, at least.
Yeah, it was the home of the American system, so-called, in its most specific sense, I think.
Mm-hmm. And this man, a couple of these gentlemen with very sad faces said, "I wish I could help you, but it's all gone. There's nothing left, none of this." And this used to be... All the universities through this Connecticut River Valley too were oriented around that, you know, machining, you know, industry, science, that sort of thing. And so that's one side. The other side, we did go up to New Hampshire. We went up to this fair in Fryeburg, Maine, which is just this big fair. Everyone, you know, it's the big thing in the area. And people we had just a small crew there, but people came from all over the country to this thing. And I think it's just a general fair, but must have some tradition to it. We just had a wildly electric response. We had four organizers. The table swamped all day. We raised like a few $100s just in a matter of hours. And tons of response. People saying, "Oh, when are you going to come to my town? I live in this corner of Maine. You know, we need this there. What can we do?" You know, people that have never seen us, people that may not have ever been political before in their lives, but there's something about they see us. They see the fact that we're calling Obama fascist. And that we're calling for the Glass-Steagall, especially. Those are the main things we see. There's also a funny thing, just as a side note, but when we tell them that when you use the 25th Amendment that you don't need to go through Congress, they have a special joy with that.
Oh.
I mean, we don't need to go through Pelosi. That's the best thing I've heard all day. What do I sign? And so that's sort of the two poles, anyway, of some of the work we've been doing, at least.
Right. And then, well, the reason I ask about Berlin, New Hampshire, I understand you happened to, speaking of going to towns and come to my town, you arrived just a few days before the last of the two remaining factories is to shut down. I don't know if you personally were there, but do you remember that?
I was not personally there. I spoke to my friends who were there, and they said there was a certain mood in the city and a certain real responsiveness to what we were saying because they knew, you know. Some of these people just have a real personal connection when you say, "Look, we need to get our physical industry back." You know, I think one of the things is when you have a real fascist system, then you have these local levels where, you know, states or municipalities or even individual companies that are forced to make these ridiculously terrible decisions where they have to cut the very thing that's productive.
Yeah.
And, you know, these inhabitants of Berlin knew what that would mean, that, you know, one of the very last productive things in their city. Well, you know, in one sense, one of the things that defines a city, you know, that doesn't make it just another collection of chain stores, you know, that has a certain identity to it. You know, in this town, we build this thing. This is what we're known. This is our history,
yeah.
You know. And that's really prevalent in New England. They have that identity. So all the more important we get these policies in to keep the people's dignity, you know.
Right. Well, let me ask you about that then further, because describe then people what you've been doing about the North American Water and Power Alliance, getting it around the perspective, enlisting people, because of course this is acting on just what you said, to restore mission for what you can make, what you can do, what the next generation will be doing. You've been having Rachel Brown during you've had meetings, right, in Massachusetts on North American Water and Power Alliance and so forth. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, we've had a lot of good responses we've done certain institutional outreach to professors of hydrology, engineering, manufacturing, biological sciences, because with the NWAPA, we are going to have to figure out, one level, you're going to have to open up whole new domains of science where you have to figure out how is mankind going to change deserts and what is it going to look like? And things like that. How are we going to begin to bioengineer some of this stuff? How is water going to affect these areas? And so we've had a good response from the institutional layers. One thing that just there's a certain irony with organizing a region like the Northeast around a project that, in one sense, has nothing to do with them. And on one lower level of thinking, we say, well, we're not going to participate in Massachusetts in a project to bring water from Alaska to New Mexico. So how does that apply? But that's what you find when politically organizing people, is the direct opposite of what a pessimist might think. Because you find that because of what we're describing with a place like Berlin, these cities, they have a real sense of the collapse of industry and science and the collapse of the mission of the country. The response in the population has been, this is what we need. This is what we need to do. There's just no doubt. And you don't really need to go through a lot of details with the population when you just lay out such an optimistic, just beautiful scientific idea like the NWAPA. We have the means, of course, on the webpage for people to look into the specifics and the literature and different things. But just in the population, they instantly latch on, and this is this sort of mass strike process we've been talking about, where they know exactly what you're talking about. They know that it's a question of a mission of the country. And that even though, they're not going to get some job necessarily from, directly from this project, but that the project represents a different mission for the country. And that's what they respond to. And it's very beautiful.
Yeah, one thing let me throw in here from, just because you mentioned the 128 corridor or circle or whatever it used to be called. I know among the many things they were involved in, there was a company there, it may still be under its name, ITEK, ITEK Optical. And they designed, and it was crafted in Massachusetts, the cameras, they called them the big camera, that would be on satellites to go around the planet to measure things on Earth. And they pioneered that. They're engineers that worked with some of your famous university departments in Boston, went on and worked on the optics and the remote sensing for the moon. Mm-hmm. And so, in a way, all of the most advanced things that are being brought out by the LaRouche Political Action Committee Basement Research Project is very – Massachusetts, New England has a very special role to resume going into space and to take our planet from the top down instead of the bottom up, like the imperialists, You probably like the machinists you ran into in Connecticut. You may run into others who say it's not here, but here's what we did or what we could do, I presume.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. You're right. It's very similar because it's hard to find where these people are. It's hard to find what they're, a lot of their companies have changed into different, Massachusetts is a big innovator, quote-unquote innovator in, healthcare technology.
Healthcare technology, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of it's gone to, certain aspects of biology or genetics. There has been a certain difficulty for us in just even finding some of these groups, and we know the names from back in, the NASA program, and we know MIT.
Right.
The biggest response has been from some of the institutions, like Worcester Polytechnic, MIT, some of these periphery schools. So it's been hard, partially because a lot of it has a feel of like a ghost town, where a lot of these companies don't exist. Some of them do. A lot of them have gone into more military applications. That's a little bit trickier to organize military companies.
Right, and also sometimes seismic and remote sensing for fossil fuel exploration or shale fracturing or something, or natural gas on the Lomonosov Ridge somewhere up in the Arctic. But hey, they can see the new horizon opening up for what you're bringing along if they're still there.
Right.
Well, John may want to bring anything out here before you have to go to your meeting, whether it's about Barney Frank or something else. But I don't want you to have to leave before you might say people's response about the necessity to get out Obama because he's in the way. I mean, could you update people on that?
Well, yeah, there's been a real shift here. I mean, New England's regarded as being pretty liberal. We've been going back to some campuses, for instance, that we haven't done for maybe 6 months.
Okay.
And you find that before, 6 months ago, you had a phenomenon of like Twitter mobs with these youth that are just, they have no, their only identity is online, is a virtual identity. And so if someone gives them a tweet, you know, using the service Twitter, that there's a group that's against Obama and come out and protest with us, and they have no real opinion on Obama, they'll just come out and rally against us sort of just because it's the liberal thing to do. We've gone back to some of these campuses, and there's a huge response. People are at the point now where there's no defense of Obama. This is just in part like this reminiscent of this famous interaction several weeks ago with this woman who said, "Look, no one campaigned for you, Obama, harder than I did, but I can't defend you anymore. What do you have to say to that?" And of course, he has no emotional connection. But on the minimum level, people cannot defend him at all. There's no one who honestly has any defense for this man except for like vicious liberals who, you know, would like to get violent with us in various forms. But
extra liberal.
But the youth. I mean, some of these youth. You gotta remember, like, if someone's 18 and a freshman in college right now, their adult life has been, you know, Bush presidencies and a couple years of Obama. So they're not drinking the Kool-Aid as far as what Obama's done, and they're very open to the fact that this guy is insane. He needs to be removed. As I mentioned earlier, the general population outside of the campuses, they know there's no denying the unemployment figures, and they know even things like the unemployment figures are bunk. You know, they know that 10% is not what it is. They know when all their neighbors are unemployed, that 10% is a number on some, you know, TV screen somewhere that the White House is trying to say, but that's not the real picture at all. So they can't deny the reality anymore. And it's a question of their response to us.
Yeah. As you were describing, the problem you have in finding industrial workers in what used to be part of one of the big industrial areas of the country. You know, it shows you the absolute fraud of this recovery. If there was a recovery, this would be one of the places where it would show up very quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd see new activity, people ramping up, things actually happening. And the fact that, you know, you're having to run around like Diogenes looking for an honest worker, you know, it just reinforces the point you're making about Obama. What a fraud this whole thing is. And the only thing... There is no recovery anywhere, not even in the financial markets, which is the way they measure recovery, because those things, no matter how much money we pump into them, are still bankrupt. So it's the whole thing is complete fraud.
Right. And I ask you about you've been describing the shutdown, or some places are like a ghost town, or, you know, of course you have former... some of the best engineering schools in the world with all their specialties. You know, I think it was out of Boston. I think the MIT, a student who was only 19 years old, solved how to deal with the original Alaska pipeline to deal with the permafrost when he was on a summer break. Because this is what you do, right?
But
The other thing, let me ask in the extreme, you know, on people being evicted or the no food left in the food pantries, do you want to say anything about New England at large in this sense on the social breakdown, just by way of an update or not?
Well, the thing I'd say just as far as, because we are organized in cities, and the people do know what, they do have a much better sense of economics than any of these so-called economists do at all, because they're real people, and they're living in a real world. But just, you know, these people see what we're doing. They see the fact that we're telling the truth on Obama. They see the fact that we're calling for Glass-Steagall, which they may or may not know what it is. But once you talk to them, just about everyone agrees with the need for Glass-Steagall and PCORA commission-type process. But the response to us has been, they come up and they just see us, something resonates with them, the honesty of what we're saying resonates with them, and they come up and they say, look, I have no money, but what can I do? What can I do? I'm sorry, I cannot help you in that way, but what can I do? There's, you know, our city's been shut down, there's no work, no, you know, we don't know what to do. You know, X and Y person I know, my neighbors, my family, they're all at work. What can I do? And that's just really promising, because it speaks to the integrity of the American population. That they might not have all the resources, but they have the courage to lead a fight for what needs to happen.
Right. And with that, let me ask you, Spencer, in your remaining minutes, do you want to, again, you had begun with Rachel Brown saying, my career is just beginning, meaning everything she stands for, her commitment, obviously, her talent, whatever she's done. What are you all planning with these forays into other states? I know in the past you even went over state lines into the Hudson Valley in New York to Albany, because in some ways it's associated with Western Massachusetts just as much as New York City. But do you want to, you're going to have these meetings on Nawapa. I know you have a tremendous cultural education drive going on with music. Can you summarize that or lay out for people? And because we want to encourage people to contribute to it themselves financially in every way. Go ahead.
Well, on one level, we're looking for every opening possible. I mean, we are looking for meetings of industrial layers. We're in cultural events, intervening in certain ways, all political discussions. We're going to organize these cities that have been shut down. We're going to organize the cities that have, you know, some things left, some industry. We're going to the campuses because some young people are thinking. A lot of young people, they may be able to think, but they're not quite. They don't quite get a sense of the economic crisis. They don't have a sense of the immediacy of the crisis, you know. But some of them do. Some of them know what's happening. So we have this meeting in Taunton today, which is just the center of the 4th district that Rachel ran in against Barney Frank. Rachel got about a third of the vote here.
Wow.
Former industrial area, and that happened a lot of places. And then we're going to have a meeting in Worcester, in central Massachusetts, in a couple of weeks, the 28th, which the info is on the LaRouche PAC webpage if people want to come to that. And so we have these series of events intended to just organize these areas and get everyone in, get every patriot of any stripe in to fight with us on every level, you know, on the industrial recovery, on the cultural question, getting these young people to have an idea of truth and not just, you know, being extreme existentialists. So we're doing everything we can think of, and we want as much help as humanly possible to do it.
Well, that's great. In the meantime here, I just want to acknowledge from Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, we did get your email. Thank you, sir, and that will come up in the next half hour. And let me say, this is the LaRouche Show on October 16th, 2010, and our guest today, you have been hearing from Spencer Cross, who's speaking to us from New England, from Taunton, Massachusetts, from LaRouche Political Action Committee event there. And also we have John Hofel in the studio with me, Marcia Mary Baker. Okay, well, Spencer, if you want to add something, we'd like to hear it. Otherwise, I guess the time has ticked by to when you want to return to the meeting. And
yeah.
I hope this is Obama's last public political event as president in Massachusetts. I don't know how fast we can get him out of there. I know he's in your territory, but you've certainly been creating conditions for him to depart. Okay.
Yeah, I just,
go
just
ahead.
On leading, I just definitely encourage people to get on the LaRouche PAC webpage and follow the off the cuffs. These are the multiple daily reports that give people the brief but thorough sense of what's developing in the population and how we at the LaRouche PAC are fighting to change that. And I encourage people to watch over the coming weeks as we move more towards a 15-hour and up newsroom, where it's going to be an international picture, a full picture from all of our offices and all of our activities around the globe, and it's up to the minute reporting on with the truth, though, not this, you know, talking head CNN or Fox News garbage, but with the real honest what's happening. So I just encourage people to follow that, and there's always our events up there, and people can contact us there to get involved and contribute and all that. So
that's great. Spencer, thanks for taking the time. And
yeah, thank you.
Yeah, come back soon. And okay, we'll say goodbye to you, and I'll repeat, that's www.larouchepac.com that he said that you can see this on. And so with that, let me turn to John here, because the phenomena we have, speaking of 28 hours of Fox News and CNN blabbing away about the foreclosure crisis, so-called. Why don't you say what we're really facing?
Well, let me start off with, there is a foreclosure crisis. I mean, you have people who, these holders of these mortgage-backed derivatives are moving to take people's homes away from them. And they're doing so quite illegally. And we have many, many cases where you see, you know, fraudulent documents prepared and submitted into court. You know, all sorts of problems. I mean, what it exposes is a tremendous criminal conspiracy. The reason why I say we should put foreclosure crisis in parentheses is because it's much the same as the subprime crisis or the credit crunch, in that these things, they're all related, and they're all actually a reflection of a larger problem, which is the derivatives problem, the way in which the financial markets have been turned into a giant casino. And that's the problem we have to solve, which is, you know, why I say, if you want to, the only kind of foreclosure we should tolerate in this country is foreclose on the British Empire through the passage of Glass-Steagall. Because Glass-Steagall is what we have to do to begin to resolve this thing. You can't just deal with it as a foreclosure problem. As much as that needs to be dealt with, that alone won't do anything.
Right. And I don't think people need us to beat on it and hear it that much. Of course, President Obama did his role and said, so what? The parasites come first. And his administration spokesman this week reiterated, go ahead and foreclose on these people and their deadbeats. And
what else? Yeah, what else is new? I mean,
yeah, right.
You know, they've been bending over for these bankers ever since they came into office. In fact, before they came into office, they were supporting the bailout, you know, and the policy has been give them whatever they want. And occasionally we'll talk a little tough just to make it look like, you know, we're maintaining some pretense of dignity. But, you know, everybody, it's clear what this is. You know, they're just the lapdogs for the financial system, this British-run financial system. And so, you know, you look at this derivatives crisis, and it's particularly the mortgage derivatives, in which you had mortgages were pooled, put into big pools by things like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and by investment banks and others. And then securities were issued against these mortgages, the pool. And this is where the fraud begins, that supposedly the securities are backed by the income stream from the mortgages. But the income streams from the mortgages are really paying back the mortgage loans. That money's really already spoken for. So what you really got is, despite all the legal dressings they put on it, is an unsecured note.
With the name mortgage thrown around to make you think there's something connected other than like tulips in 1600 or something.
So then they take these mortgage-backed securities and they break them up into pieces and they sell off the pieces. And the pieces are then, some of them, combined in other securities which are then broken into pieces and sold off, some of which are combined into other securities, and, you know, so on. And then you have credit default swaps, which are written on these things, and then people take the credit default swaps and turn them into yet more securities, which are divided into pieces. So you have a number of problems here. One is that at the end of this process, who can you say that owns the right to collect on the mortgage to your house? Because it's divided up among an unknown number of individuals and institutions, none of which by themselves have any right to foreclose. All right. Then you have this game that was played where they would take, they put them in these mortgage, the trust, the banks that would create these things would create these trusts, and the trust would hold the mortgages. And in order to make it work for the bankruptcy law, they would say, you know, we don't own these things, we're holding them in trust. You know, but they were basically, what has come out is they were defrauding the IRS, they were playing all sorts of tax games. They were not recording these changes as required in by filings at the county. They weren't signing over and processing the documents. So all of the legal chain of title, you know, is up in the air. They created this phony thing called MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration System, which is really not, it's not a real company even, it's just a database which issues rubber stamps to certify that, you know, you want to foreclose, yeah, we'll certify that you own the property, you know. And so the whole thing is just rife with illegality, corruption, and, you know, there's, nobody knows who owns what. Nobody knows how many times each property has been sold. You know, the whole thing is just a god-awful mess. And there's no way to really unravel it. You know, so the banks say, well, you should just take our word for it. No, we're not going to take their word for it. So that's one level. This whole thing is corrupt. But even if they had dotted all of the I's and crossed all of the T's, and done all of the paperwork and all of these steps properly, it would still be a fraud. Because the derivatives are not worth anything. It's funny money. It's phony. And this is the big problem you see playing out right now, which is that when the derivatives holders see that, you know, when his loans don't get paid back and things because the economy is collapsing.
Yes, even if someone legally was gouging you and looting you,
yeah,
for the more you can't pay,
yeah,
and it's passed along to the holder of the speculative bet on top, piled
right,
on top.
Right.
Okay.
So this speculative frenzy, this turning the economy into a casino, has killed your job to the point where you can no longer pay your mortgage. And then they come along and they say, our derivative gives us the right to take your house away. Well, no, it doesn't. You know, and so, but the derivatives, they want to cash out. They want to say, okay, we have all this funny money. We want to turn this into something real because it's all collapsing. So we're going to take your house. You know, no, because it's funny money. You don't, it's not a legal claim. This stuff should all be declared null and void and absolutely illegal. From a moral standpoint, they have no right to foreclose either. Because this system is the thing, and this is basically the Inner Alpha Group system, the British Empire, created the conditions which destroyed the economy, which have thrown, you know, how many unknown millions of people out of work, have caused all sorts of problems. So you run up by creating these derivatives and taking some of the profits and pumping them back into new mortgages, you run up the real estate prices to the point where people are paying exorbitant fees to buy new homes. You know, they need homes, but this, you know, you got to pay a, you know, an arm and a leg to buy your new house. Then the economy collapses. You can't make your payments, and they want to take your house away. You know, so you have to deal with the whole thing. You have to start off by saying, we are not going to take anyone's house away, period. We're going to protect people while we straighten all this out. That we are not going to see we're not going to honor derivatives contracts. We're going to declare them all null and void. And that includes mortgage-backed securities and everything that follows up that chain of insanity. That, you know, if you can't pay, will there are ways to work these things out so that whoever actually legally owns that loan, you know, will work it out. But you're not going to lose your house because we're in a financial crisis. This is not your fault. This was not caused by the little people messing things up, as the banks would have us believe.
Yeah.
It was caused by corruption and looting and stealing from the top down. And so you have to solve it from that approach. Nothing less will work.
Let me throw in one here, something that you wrote about in the article. I mentioned to people, if you don't get even more subscriptions, if you already have one to EIR online, John's article on this will be out, posted this coming week. But the thing is, you're describing this as an inherent character of this system we've had for decades, during the time that you mentioned the name InterAlpha Group of Banks, dating from, formally speaking, 1971, but it's a continuation of this kind of system. But this is one feature of it, this entire mortgage securitization derivatives episode. And you mentioned other things in the article, namely that we're seeing now a big cartelization of commodity control, consolidation of what banks, so-called banks, are still out there, and as well as this, the polite term is import dependence, only a few areas on the planet producing, and the control of this rigged so-called free trade. Can you just say about that to underscore what you're saying, that it's that this isn't some just isolated episode, the nature of the beast that is all these things?
Yeah, that one of the purposes, the British Empire, coming out of World War II, the United States was the strongest economy on the face of the earth. All right, and as such was a mortal threat to the existence of the empire, because the empire is a looting mechanism. And whenever it's faced with nation states which are strong enough to resist it, as the United States clearly was under FDR, then, you know, we have the power to put an end to their system. So they decided that their primary need coming out of World War II was to destroy the United States. And since militarily they couldn't touch us, they decided that what they were going to do was induce us to commit suicide, economic suicide. And that's what this InterAlpha Group really is. It's the way to organize this giant financial bubble. So we go along, we have these, one aspect of it is globalization, in which we take our productive jobs and we ship them overseas, supposedly because it's more profitable, when actually it's destructive. And you have then the rise of these giant cartels, which was also part of this, because the particular form of fascism that they're pushing is corporatism. So it's basically, it's rule, it's a return to the model of the British East India Company, in effect, where you have giant corporate interest which control everything. The bankers control the corporations, and the corporations control the production and distribution of goods. And, you know, for make every country dependent upon these cartels for some necessities of life. And this has been the process, this continuing cartelization of everything, of food, of industry, of raw materials, of finance. You know, look at the way you have these giant banks now. You have four banks which dominate the U.S. banking system.
Yeah.
Right. This is, we're going to the British model. We're reorganizing our country according to the British model, except that we're being looted at the same time. We're destroying ourselves. And, you know, our economy now is in ruins. And now we're getting ready. Now we're moving into the phase where we're going to destroy our own financial system. And who's going to, the benefit is going to be to the British Empire. And that's what's been going on. And that's, this mortgage game was one of the ways in which this was done, that you get people hooked on enormous amounts of debt that they can never pay. Then the nation blows up when you can't pay the debt. And then they come in and they start taking everything under foreclosure, saying, well, you know, now we're going to own your country.
Right. We created this funny money paper, mm-hmm. and now we're going to cash in on it.
Yeah. Our rights to our funny money is more important than your life.
Yeah.
And you're going to pay.
Well, let me I'll just identify the Stroudsburg emailer. Thank you, because it's related to this. I think he's asking mostly about, you have a whole category of 401k. You had other kind of pensions. Many of these is like CalPERS. Mm-hmm. Of course, if there's nothing going on in your economy and there's no opportunity for honest investment, in various degrees, these kind of funds have blown out. Do you want to say anything? That's part of the picture. Do you want to say anything about this?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the pensions, by and large, are already gone. You know, people have to face up to the fact that their money has been frittered away, that if your pension fund, which by law was required to invest in things with the highest return, which means the most risky stuff, you know, your money was used to fund the building of this bubble, and then when the bubble pops, you lose your money. So there is no real pension. It's like a good example is the case of the Enron pensions from some years ago.
Okay.
You know, one day you'd have people who thought they had million-dollar pensions.
That's right.
And the next day they didn't have it. But the problem is they never really had it in the first place. And you have this illusion. You can make it a statement saying you have all this money, but the money's in worthless paper. So, you know, in order to protect people, what we have to do, really, is go to a different mode and say, okay, now that we've lost all this money, how are we going to protect people? And that's where the role of the government comes in. You have to have the government step in like FDR did and say, okay, we've got a major crisis here. We've lost all this money. We've been stolen blind. You know, we're going to reorganize this financial system. We're going to restore order, and we're going to make sure that people are protected. Nobody goes hungry. Nobody loses their house. You know, we're going to take care of people. You may not get what you thought you were going to get, but we're going to take care of you. Nobody dies.
And you're into reality. We recognize we haven't been producing things. So those of the age group and, you know, who can and can teach others, mobilize for North American Water and Power Alliance kind of production. And for the seniors, the young, you can make arrangements. That was the other part of the email. You have Social Security, you have Social Security for the disabled or for the seniors, of course.
Assuming we get Obama out.
Yes, that's right. I was just going to say, because this week he said, oh, there's no inflation, mm-hmm. so therefore we're not going to increase it. We already have a system, but we'll just make sure and stiff people.
Well, yeah, he says there's no inflation, so therefore we don't need any cost of living adjustments. The idiot Ben Bernanke at the Fed says that we don't have enough inflation. And that his job is to raise the inflation levels to the norm.
Yes.
These people are completely insane. Yes. They don't necessarily believe what they're saying, because what their impulse is save their system, the money system. And they come up with all sorts of rationalizations of why they have to do it. But it's really, you know, it's childish impulses. We have to save it. We have to save it. You know, I mean, the policy is made in the diaper, and and then the rationalization comes from the mind. So they spin excuses. Oh, this sounds good. We can't admit why we're really doing this, so we'll come up with this good-sounding excuse. Inflation is too low, so therefore we need another round of bailout.
Right. In other words, this is the kind of thing that you can hear by the paid talking heads 24 hours a day on Fox News, CNN, MSNBC, and the rest. You can get an explanation per minute of what happened in the diaper.
Yes. Now, they're not exactly, they're not street walkers because they're in the studio, so I guess you'd have to call them studio walkers.
Yeah, the other names can be suggested. You can fill them in yourself. Now, that takes us to something else that you occasionally bring out. You've done so in this recent article that we should foreclose on the empire. You raised the susceptibility of the general public in recent decades, or take the time period you're mentioning, since the terrible Truman period after the death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And people were susceptible to thinking, well, I got my, I'll put it in, dramatize it in recent terms. I do have my 401k. I do have my Missouri State pension plan. I did get a good deal on my house, and it should increase in value, appreciate. So I do see that the whole country's falling apart, and other people don't have jobs, but I'm okay, Jack. So you're talking about the susceptibility of people to be preyed upon.
Yeah, that we were sold a bill of goods. The trick is to let people, to make people think they're participating in the scheme.
Okay.
You know, the con man comes to you and says, look, we're going to rip this guy off over here, and I need your help. And if you help me, you'll get rich.
Okay.
And you say, yeah, okay, that sounds good. And only later do you find out that the guy you're ripping off was working with the con man, and you're the target. And so it's this, you know, it's what Lynn keeps talking about, the pleasure-pain principle, the, you know, the classic British psychological manipulation. You do what we want, we reward you. You don't do what we want, we punish you. So you have the pleasure, the CEOs, as we were building up the bubble, got all of these stock options, made enormous amounts of money. Why? Because that was the reward they were given for going along with this shareholder values thing, which helped destroy the economy. So in a sense, you know, the CEOs were like the dog who gets the cookie. You know, sit, heel, do what you're told, and then we'll give you a cookie. And, you
so
know.
This is the destruction period you're talking about for decades.
Yeah.
The CEOs, you're not even talking about the day trader saga. You're talking about someone who would otherwise be a plant manager who
yeah.
went along when the glass
right.
factory was moved from New York to Mexico.
Yeah.
Or Green Giant moved from Minnesota
yeah.
to Mexico. Or,
yeah.
okay.
or also the Wall Street bankers who got the big bonuses, or the takeover artist who got paid enormous amounts of money for tearing apart companies and throwing people out of work and all of these things. You know, that this is the, they call it the creative destruction of Joseph Schumpeter. But
okay.
it's not, with emphasis on the destruction, that this is how you tear apart an economy under the rationale of improving it. Because you're not really improving anything, you're just asset stripping, you're tearing it apart. And so the people who do this are allowed to get extremely rich. And therefore, they keep doing it, other people want to do it, you know, and then you set, so the if the money is made by tearing things apart, suddenly you have all sorts of people who are engaged in tearing things apart. And you get rewarded. It's pleasure. And then, meanwhile, the flip side is that the people whose lives are being destroyed are feeling the pain. But, you know, so what?
It's not, I mean, that's, at the moment.
I mean, ultimately, the empire plans to kill them anyway, so what difference does it make? You know, it's like shearing the sheep before you lure them into the slaughterhouse.
Right. Now, so let me, to recap again, you, a couple of years ago, or two, 3 years ago, you were on the show, or you would say, with the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, which was the approach in draft form for legislative action that Mr. LaRouche put out in the LaRouche Political Action Committee, said at the time we could deal with this. Already
yeah.
knowing, by the way, John, that what's now blown up into what was already known all along, that there was funny business, like Cleveland, Ohio, Deutsche Bank, I think, was infamous there
yeah.
several years ago. That so this was, it's not as if this wasn't known. It was just protected. But you're saying the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, which people can see on LaRouche Political Action Committee, LaRouchePAC.com, this, the essence of this and Glass-Steagall federally is the way to go.
Yes. Absolutely. They're part of the same principle. The principle of how do you deal with this kind of imperial criminal operation? We have to bust it up. And the way you bust it up is with national sovereignty. Glass-Steagall is an assertion of national sovereignty. We're saying, all right, you're not calling the shots anymore. We are. And we're going to protect our people. We're going to protect our economy. We're going to protect our nation. You can't do this to us anymore. And so that in itself changes everything. Just the mere passage of Glass-Steagall, because it signals, I mean, the British have made it clear officially to our government that they would regard the passage of Glass-Steagall as a hostile act. And for good reason. For good reason. Because that would show basically that that LaRouche's influence is now very strong in the United States, that we're taking over, and that their game is up because we're not going to tolerate it. And, you know, you think about in 2007, you had a couple of hedge funds belonging to Bear Stearns, which collapsed. And the result was that the entire securities market went into a panic. It froze. Not because these two hedge funds were so important, but because of the implications of the fact that the game was over, the pyramid scheme was over. Now, they resolved that crisis basically by tapping into the national wallet and just stealing money out of the federal government, with the complicity of the Bush administration and then the Obama administration and the Federal Reserve. You know, so more grist for the PCORA hearings there. But now we've reached the point where that's not going to work anymore. So if we pass Glass-Steagall, there is nowhere for them to go. Their game is truly over, and it will collapse. The passage of Glass-Steagall will pop that balloon because there's nothing left for them, and they know it. So that means that that immediately brings up the question of the whole bankruptcy reorganization and all of the other things that we need to do. They go back to a fixed exchange rate monetary system, the implementation of a credit system, you know, the Four Powers Agreement to reorganize and rebuild the world, the NWAPA, the Mars mission. All of these things will flow because they become a necessity that we bring this thing to a head. It's already bankrupt. It can't be saved. The longer we try to bail it out, the more it's going to cost us in not only money, but in lives, in jobs, in people. I mean, you know, we're destroying our nation. We're collapsing civilization in order to try to bail out all this funny money, and it can't be done. I mean, we can collapse civilization, but we're not going to save that system. So you have to stop it. And the way you break that cycle is with Glass-Steagall. And immediately you enter a new world where all sorts of things were possible that weren't possible before, because you've asserted your national sovereignty in a very direct way. And that's the real secret to beating an empire: assertion of national sovereignty. And not only asserting it, but backing it up.
Right. Well, absolutely. And I think you make us think we don't have to go into it more in depth, but the original, was it Senators Glass and Steagall, or was it House? 1933.
Yeah, one from the Senate, one from the House.
That's right. One from the House. There was a frame of mind to be able to get together and put in something to take. Now, this is the frame of mind that is out there potentially, as Spencer Cross was just reporting from the LaRouche Political Action Committee meeting in Massachusetts in New England. We can do so. This there can be this moment of change. But on the enemy side, you've mentioned the Inter-Alpha group of banks, this network. You can date it to 1971, but that's just one milestone in its phase. But this is, as you said, this is a blowing of a bubble, a particular mortgage-connected bunch of derivatives that is blowing out for mm-hmm. those who think they're in control or whatever they think. What do you think? How would you describe the enemy at this stage?
Well, they're completely and hopelessly bankrupt.
Okay.
I mean, just take a look at the Inter-Alpha group of banks, all right? The flagship of this thing is the Royal Bank of Scotland.
Okay.
Nationalized by the British government. You know, now that doesn't mean the British government runs it. That just means that the British government is paying the bills. Allied Irish Bank, another Inter-Alpha bank, just nationalized by the Irish government. Huge bailouts, enormous amounts of money being thrown into this thing. Banco Santander, the global powerhouse, has been on life support from the European Central Bank for a long time. I mean, these things are hopelessly bankrupt because they were never intended. They were never real banks. They were never building anything. They were looting mechanisms. And after you suck all the lifeblood out of something, you know, what happens to the fleas when you kill the dog? You know, so they're just ephemeral. The system that the Inner Alpha Group represents is what's more important. It's a conduit for certain for power, as opposed to the power coming from the individual institutions. And they're bankrupt. And if we go with Glass-Steagall, they're all gone.
Well, that's a great note in which we're going to end this show. It's been October 16th, 2010, the LaRue Show. Do listen October 23rd. Will be weekly and on November 6th. Mr. LaRouche will have an international webcast at 1 Eastern Time. So this is Marcia Mary Baker. I want to thank John Hofel, and we look forward to putting this enemy out of its misery. Thank you, John.